On this week's 51%, hear how a survey aims to involve Black women in public policy.
But I think the ultimate success is like being able to bring a large gathering of Black women together and say, like, this is how we want to show up politically.
Meet two young women who searched for their biological fathers, and writer Dr. Jerry Byrne shares her view on manners. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. A multiracial, member-led organization that works to build power and social equality in New York State has launched a survey for Black women, seeing them as drivers for public policy and governance. The aim is to involve Black women without having them necessarily run for office. Community Voices Heard Power has chapters in New York City and four counties north of the city in the Hudson Valley. Juanita Lewis is Community Voices Heard Hudson Valley Organizing Director.
I mean, we decided to launch this survey because, you know, Black women have been consistent voters and a consistent voting bloc for many, many, many years, and have been seen as the, I would say, like the backbone of the Democratic Party in particular. And when there have been elections that have been narrowly won, it's been because Black women came out and are being thanked for their participation. But when it comes to real policies that will impact us or having us at the decision-making table, we're not a part of that. And so we decided to do this survey to begin to capture what were things that Black women cared about, how do they see themselves politically beyond just also running for office, because we realized that there was a lot of data and trainings and articles about women who want to run for office, but not always stories about how do Black women identify politically beyond voting in a political party. You know, how do they see participating in like a parent-teacher organization or in their faith-based institution or cultural groups as being political or civic-minded? So we said, let's start at home. So let's go ahead and survey 5,000 women who identify as Black to get some of that information. And then to be able to bring that information forward to some decision makers at the state and federal level to get a real conversation going, that would be part of a platform we would want to see develop.
She says the goal is to get back 2,500 surveys from New York City and 2,500 from the rest of the state by the end of June.
You know, we have women filling out the survey, hosting what we're calling sister circles, where they're bringing together their girlfriends to talk about, you know, things that they're impacted by or how they see themselves politically. And then, you know, letting them know about the town halls coming up and things of that nature. And it's interesting about the survey because it's really just generating a lot of conversations with folks. Like, for instance, I was talking to a girlfriend of mine who filled it out, and she was like, oh, I don't think I'm really political. And I said, aren't you like involved in your kids' Girl Scout troop? Don't you go to like PTO meetings? You're active in your church, right? And she said, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I do a lot. I said, exactly, right? Like, we don't think about that automatically when it comes to our civic engagement or our political engagement and how those things are connected or should be connected to particular policies that we'd want to see pushed or advocated for.
Lewis says responses are coming back, but she hasn't had a chance to review them yet.
Like, one of our members actually has been going out canvassing and getting women to fill out the survey. And it's allowed her to get into some conversations with some folks. And the biggest one is, oh, no one's ever asked me these questions before. And I was like, oh, okay. No one's ever asked me, which, you know, lets you think, oh, okay, so someone's actually valuing what makes me a person. Okay.
She says there is one question that could be considered specific to a survey of Black women.
I wouldn't say this isn't a question we wouldn't ask, but I don't know if I've seen this question asked a lot around ethnic breakdown. So we break down like Caribbean and African and Latinx communities. And I don't know what that would look like for white women, right?
She speaks to the timeline around the survey.
So, you know, we said that we wanted to get, you know, all the survey responses in by the end of June, be able to analyze some of the data in July, and then hold at least one of our first town halls in August. I think we might tweak the timeline a little bit, but I like that's, you know, that's the baseline that we're going with.
Lewis says the survey is already yielding an opportunity for connections and relationships.
I think one aspect of success would be, you know, being able to now have contact information for Black women across New York State, and then being able to connect with them around the work that we're doing as, like, as an individual organization, but then also to be able to relate to other organizations or partners that are, that have said they want to be a part of the survey. Like, I'm just learning about some other organizations that are in the state that I'm like, oh, I didn't know you were around. And that's really cool, because if there's an opportunity for us to align, we want to do that. If there's an opportunity for the women who fill out the survey and say, I want to be aligned with X type of organization, we would now have a relationship to pass them on to, right? And that wouldn't have happened had we not done this survey. So I think it's the relationships, the opportunity for relationships and connections. And then also the work with organizations that want to partner. But I think the ultimate success is like being able to bring a large gathering of Black women together and say, like, this is how we want to show up politically, right? Like, we're defining what that looks like. No one else is defining it for us. We're defining it because someone asked us, and we're, you know, and we want to see what that looks like and put that forth to somebody, which is super exciting.
Juanita Lewis is Community Voices Heard Hudson Valley Organizing Director. The survey effort is called Follow Black Women, a survey for the front lines. From Community Voices Heard, Power. As a kid, Joy Dolo was shy. Now she's an actor, a member of the comedy troupe Blackout Improv, and a podcaster. KFAI's Dixie Treichel produced this audio portrait.
My name is Joy Dolo, and I'm an actor and improviser, sometimes teacher, writer, director. I do a little bit of everything. Yeah, you know, it all actually started when I was in middle school, actually. I, believe it or not, used to be very, very shy. One day, Kevin Dutcher, who's still a performer in town, came up to my table and was like, I'm directing a play. I would love for you to audition. And I said, no. And he said, I'll see you after school. And so I started there. And after that, I found this confidence and this voice that I didn't know I have. And ever since then, I knew, like, this is the career that I want to do. I do mostly stage acting, and I think my philosophy on it is just to show that as a Black woman, I'm a three-dimensional person. Theater has the power to show humanity and show different sides to people, and I feel like I'm able to create these characters from my environment and my experience that showcases the depth of humanity that I have, because people tend to put Black people, especially Black women, into categories or tropes. Categories really diminishes us as humans, and I really believe in the power of theater to showcase those different sides of things.
Which is the right one. Just trust it. Lift each other up. If somebody looks like they're struggling, help them. But have fun. Tell the truth when you need to. Be real. Speak from your gut. Speak from your diaphragm.
The improv started out. It was a challenge to me because improv is scary, and I just wanted to see if I could do it. But when I started doing it, I realized that I was excelling at it. The group Blackout Improv. We started 3.5 years ago. Me and a few other actors and talents got together and we're like, we're not being showcased on the stage. Why is that? We're all funny, right? Basically, what we do is we ask the audience to give us a topic that they would like to hear from the point of view of Black people. And we talk about this thing from our point of view, and then we flip the script and create these scenes around these ideas in that conversation. But it's really important for people to know that with comedy, it has to start with truth. And then we're able to have those conversations that you can't have being the only one in a white group. Like, we can talk about how we feel isolated, or we can talk about how we feel like we don't belong in certain spaces, or how we feel like our voices aren't heard. And then we're able to have the comedic aspect of it.
Marcus, tell him how wonderfully our hands fit together. How sweetly.
I'm the host of a show called Forever Ago through American Public Media. And it's a show that's a child of Brains On. They talk about science. We talk about the history of objects, the history of sandwiches and skateboards and shoes. And like, how did it get to be where it is? And most of the things you're like, oh, you know, it might have started in like the 70s or the 60s, which seems so long ago for some of us. But most things started way, way back in ancient prehistoric times. And I'm devising a piece with Laverne Seifert, who's from Théâtre de la Jeune Lune. We're working on a piece around seniors and technology. And and it's me and him essentially trying to figure out how to make this sensual journey through this new world that we're living in 2019 of cell phones and computers and microphones. Yeah, and it's going to travel around Minnesota.
Next, we'll meet two young college women who have a lot in common, including the need to find their fathers.
I'm Raven, and this is Ebony.
I remember this one guy came up to me, and he was like, "Hey, Raven," downtown, and I was like, nope, that's not who I am.
Ebony Farnes is a short, brunette, half-black girl with a fashion sense. What I mean is, she works at the Gap, and so she looks like she works at the Gap. Pretty put together. I mean, I try.
It's pretty funny because people do get really embarrassed. But I know we actually do kind of look alike.
Ebony and I are on the same college campus in Missoula, Montana. There are not a lot of people who look like us in Missoula, Montana. But I can't really blame white people here because the similarities are kind of weird. And also, we're friends. But this is about everything we have in common that you can't see. We both didn't know who our biological dads were until after we knew each other. I'd been curious for most of my life. I wanted to meet him when I was in grade school, maybe 6 or 7, but my dad opted not to see me. My mom says he wasn't in my life before because he wasn't ready to be a father. It was something that took me a while to understand. With Ebony, her biological dad was out of the picture from day one. Her mom was 15 when she had Ebony, and she ended up turning over her baby to her parents. They adopted Ebony, so they're technically her grandparents, but she doesn't see it that way.
And so my parents here in Missoula raised me. I have 5 older siblings that are, they're all my parents' biological kids, but they're my adoptive siblings. And I had a really normal life growing up here, just being the youngest, I got super spoiled, which was awesome.
Both of us, eventually, and around the same time in our lives, figured we needed to know about these dudes who helped create us. With me, my Aunt Tracy kind of made things happen. I met my dad, Troy, for the first time on my 20th birthday. This happened in Phoenix, Arizona, where he lives. With Ebony, it started with Ancestry.com.
For over 30 years, you've connected to your family history with Ancestry.
And through Ancestry DNA, I took that test when I was a senior in high school.
Ebony's birth mom died when Ebony was in 8th grade. Her birth mom had also tried to find people, namely her own birth father.
He has the most basic name, and she always tried to find him, but his name is Mike Adams. That sounds like a fake name. Impossible to find, too.
It took a while and a few emails to people who might have a connection.
And I messaged all of them. I was like, "Hey, do you know Mike Adams? I believe he's my grandpa, blah, blah, blah." A bunch of them were like, "No, that does not sound familiar at all." And then one of them messaged me back, and he was like, "Hey, my mom said that she had a cousin named Mike Adams."
Turns out the correct Mike Adams lives in Arlee, which is not even 30 miles from Missoula.
And has lived there my whole life, pretty much. So close and never knew. But I got in contact with him this past summer, and he was really shocked at first, but then he was really excited to hear from me, which was a great relief. I was kind of nervous that he wouldn't want anything to do with me. And then we ended up meeting in October. And that was so awesome. He just looked so cool. And I met all his, like, biker friends. And they were all so nice, even though they all looked like major tough guys.
Ebony has managed to meet her grandpa, her grandmother, and her aunts and uncles. And through all of her digging around, she also learned her birth father's name was Chuck. Ebony read through some of her mom's old journal entries and found out Chuck has been arrested in Billings. She wasn't 100% sure she wanted to find her dad, but she was curious enough to check the roster for the Yellowstone County Jail.
I literally entered first name Charles and then race Black.
She says he looked crazy in his mugshot, but then she found another photo where he looked kind of like a groovy guy.
He had a really cool mustache. He looked like a movie star, like a short little afro. He's tall, like 6 foot, pretty muscular. But yeah, he looked like a really cool looking guy.
People say that about my dad too. My mom says he looks like Tyrese Gibson, that model who was in the Transformers movies. And get this, there are even more similarities. Ebony's biological father had a secret life when he was in Montana. Before she was born, he had another family. Down in Colorado, he had a wife and a 2-year-old daughter.
He was married to her mother for about 13 years, and so he had this kind of secret life where he was in Montana, and that's like how I came about.
So my dad had a daughter with his wife before he met my mom. Her name is Devin, and she's only 3 years older than me. I've met her, but not the whole choir. But I will, at a wedding, this summer. And even though Ebony's still not sure about meeting her dad, she does want to meet her half-sister, Kamara.
Yeah, and actually she's engaged to a really sweet man, and they're getting married this summer. And that'll be the first time I actually get to meet my sister. So I'm super excited.
Did I mention we have some similarities? In Missoula, Montana, I'm Raven McMurray.
Some doctors see access to birth control as a way to decrease maternal and infant mortality, but a history of abuse has led to distrust of medical professionals in communities of color. Side Effects Public Media's Lauren Bavis spoke with Dr. Bronson Tucker Edmonds of the Indiana University School of Medicine about systemic racism, reproductive health, and how contraception fits into these issues.
What is long-acting reversible contraception, and why are doctors pushing to discuss using LARC with their patients, particularly right after giving birth?
There are a couple of different types of long-acting reversible contraception, but basically two large categories. One are intrauterine devices, or IUDs as commonly referred to, and those are devices that are inserted into a woman's uterus, and they can reside there for there are actually some new devices, but we'll say 5 years to 10 years. Some of them contain progesterone, some of them are copper, sort of different varieties of those, but those are intrauterine devices. And then the other category of long-acting reversible contraception, which I will call LARC from here on out because it's a mouthful, are the subdermal implants. We know that women who have pregnancies too close together are at increased risk for complications in those next pregnancies, for lower birth weights, for preterm delivery. So being able to space pregnancies out is a really important part of prenatal care, actually, of pregnancy and maternal child sort of care.
So LARC is a good option for many women, but it comes with heavy baggage for women of color. Why is that?
The Black community in particular, and communities of color, have wondered sometimes whether or not family planning programs were really intended to, you know, control women of color in terms of their bodies, their reproduction, whether they were, there's been, you know, people have pointed to or had concerns and conspiracies with regard to genocide and, you know, different types of ways to really try to keep Black women from reproducing. And so that's sort of a long history and sort of culturally embedded set of concerns that I think just based on a history of mistreatment within sort of the healthcare community and otherwise that we sort of wrestle with as a community.
What's it like for you as an OBGYN and a woman of color to provide care for these patients?
So I think though that it does help because I do sort of have that double consciousness. Like I'm aware of the ways that women of color have been treated historically and still today in our healthcare system. And I have sort of this perspective and this medical training that helps me to understand that that can be true, and it can also be true that there are sort of medical, you know, technologies and treatments that can be of service to us as a community.
What is reproductive justice, and how can it play a role in healthcare?
It was largely a movement that grew out of sort of Black women's response, in large part to sort of what had begun as sort of a white middle class feminist movement that seemed to not really speak to the full experience of more marginalized populations. Reproductive justice was really trying to attend to that and saying that women should be able to, choose if they want to parent. They should be able to choose when they want to parent, but they should also be able to parent under circumstances that really were both safe and supportive of them being able to raise their children to reach their full potential.
That was Dr. Bronson Tucker Edmonds of the Indiana University School of Medicine speaking with Side Effects Public Media's Lauren Bavis.
Good manners means just being kind. I have super manners, yes, I do. I always start with please and end with thank you. Thank you.
And now writer Dr. Jerry Burns presents us with her take on manners.
One day, my husband and I went to see a movie. There were two people ahead of us in the ticket line, a mom and her son. When they got their tickets, they proceeded to the glass doors leading to the inner lobby. The young boy grabbed the door and started to dart in, his sights set on the candy. "Stop, honey," his mother gently reminded him. "You need to hold the door for the man." An older gentleman, it turned out, was just behind them. The child sighed a put-upon sigh, grabbed the door again, but this time let the older man through first before he burst in to ogle at the sweets. His mother turned and winked at me. Her sparkling eyes and sweet expression said, "Yes, we parents need to do this stuff. We don't always like to do this stuff, but it's what parents do." Amazing how effective nonverbal communication between strangers can be. But it's not just parents. Grown-ups of all stripes remind children about their manners all the time. But reminding grown-ups about their manners, that's a whole other ballgame. And reminding an entire profession, whew, that's tricky. I've been thinking about this a lot since I scheduled my annual exam at the Women's Health Center. When I called, I was told that my carefully selected doctor left the practice. "Who would you like to see instead?" the voice on the other end of the phone bubbled as I groaned in disappointment. "I don't know the other doctors. Which one would I like?" See, I need to like my doctors. Many make me uncomfortable because I just don't do professional brusque. In any context. But women's health is particularly delicate for me. Yes, it's intimate and personal for everyone concerned, but on top of that, I had a complicated medical situation at the end of college and had to use a gynecologist who was brusque on steroids. Not only was she curt when she was at her sweetest, but she was judgmental and scary. Ever since, I seek doctors who are known for their competence and their bedside manner. But a good bedside manner does not always include all the classic manners we teach our kids. My newly departed gynecologist is a kind and lovely woman, and yet she didn't say goodbye. In my experience, doctors don't warn their patients or send a goodbye email. They just go. If I had known this doctor was leaving, I would have tried to see her before she left, which is probably one of the reasons doctors don't say goodbye. I also understand that it's impossible for a medical practice to accommodate last-minute goodbye checkups. Medical practices also can't afford to have their departing physicians leave like medical Pied Pipers with a trail of patients scurrying after them. I get why it happens like this. Still, despite the professional expediency of this never-can-say-goodbye practice, after I've bared my proverbial soul and lady bits to someone without a courteous adieu evokes the yucky aspect of a regretful one-night stand. I asked the office assistant who was scheduling my appointment for the names of good, nice doctors in the practice. She named one right off the bat and got me an appointment. Trepidation accompanied me when I went to the office for the thrills of my annual exam. The doctor came in and extended her hand in greeting. Nice manners there. But her office is in the hospital and the flu was rampant at the time of my visit. There was hand sanitizer at every doorway, and warning signs hung everywhere asking people with symptoms of illness to wear face masks. And my new doctor was wearing a face mask. I just couldn't bring myself to shake her hand. I apologized profusely and explained that my hesitation was only about the flu. "I just can't afford to be down with the flu for 2 weeks," I said. So she marched over to the sink, washed and dried her hands, and then her eyes crinkled and brightened. That's how I knew she was smiling beneath the mask, when she thrust out a freshly scrubbed hand. I shook it gratefully. Now that's a doctor who listens without judgment. Though we didn't exactly start on the right hand, we did end up starting on the right foot. And believe it or not, we had a blast during the exam. Yes, you heard me correctly. I said that I had fun at a gynecological exam. Treating people well is important around movie theater doorways and when meeting new people or patients. But don't we teach children that it's equally important to greet people and say goodbye to them? As for me, at least now I can look forward to next year's annual exam like a movie and popcorn. Well, okay, not quite that much. That is, as long as my new doctor is still there.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1558.